Well, that essay kind of uses Scheherazade and the story of the woman who, the king, who kills a woman every night. He weds a woman and kills her every night. And then his vizier's daughter is chosen to be his newest bride. And she knows that to survive, she has to keep him from killing her. So every night she tells him a story that's so good that he wants to keep her alive for another night to tell a story. And for a long time, you know, I've taught young women writing. I've taught, you know, writing, creative writing workshops for young women. And the story had always been a way of me kind of entering into a more dynamic way of getting them to tell the stories that they actually care about. Saying storytelling is an emergency. It's not like a cute thing. It's not like you want to write a story that's going to make you famous. You want to tell the story that's going to keep you alive. Like Scheherazade, her stories are these adrenaline-fueled attempts to actually save her life. And so as we tell stories, we should ask ourselves, what are the stories that will keep me alive? Because if they keep me alive, they may keep other people alive. But then I was thinking about storytelling, as I often do, as being a non-human event, as being something that we belong to, but we didn't invent. And I was thinking about the earth itself, you know, Gaia, the Great Mother, whatever you, the biosphere, you know, as being a kind of Scheherazadean character that is telling these stories with hurricanes, with heat waves, with forest fires to try and get our attention, to stay alive, to say, come on, pay attention. And I think that's the interesting thing is we are so culturally shut down to our sensory experience that I feel like we've been sensorially receiving climate information for a long time. Like you mentioned smell, and I was thinking like, I think that things have probably smelled wrong for a long time, but it's things are just loud enough now that in our very shuttered, very simplistic existence, we're finally paying attention. Mm-hmm. But the stories have to get loud.
Yeah, that seems to be the... This was something that was touched on with Dare in that conversation you had with them.
Yeah.
That our culture, if you want to call it that, or civilization or whatever it is, really shutters off our senses and our ability to sense things. I mean, with all the senses we have.
I think people are so attracted to these big heroic psychedelic experiences. They just want to turn on their senses. And a psychedelic experience will wake up those senses, but you also have that available to you every single day.
Mm-hmm. I've talked about psychedelics. I've kind of backed off a bit just because I haven't had many lately in my life, but I think it was one of those things where when I had that first mushroom experiences mostly, the senses that I, my sense of smell, taste, and not just them as distinct separate categories of senses, but they were blending together in such a particular way. And it was overwhelming because I was realizing in that experience, like I had access, I felt like on some level I had access to this the entire time, but I, whether consciously or not, didn't want to have that intensity of felt experience because it was too much to like live in this place and in this time and with my body in this, like it was too much to take in all the time because it was hard. It was hard.
And I also think that sensory gating is a survival technique. Like you want to be able to hear your name called in a room of people talking. So you have to be able to gate out all the other noise to distinguish your name. You know, you want to be able to see an animal coming at you through the woods. So you have to be able to block out all the other visual stimuli. So you see that perturbation, that movement. So I think that gating is actually something that is helpful. The problem is that I think the way we used to homogenize our the kind of sensory stimuli we register had a lot more to do with an understanding of how land worked and how weather worked. But now it has to do with abstractions and with structures that are totally man-made and have nothing to do with our actual somatic survival. So I think that's the really hard thing, is we do need to gate out, you know, to let in all the stimulus is to be totally overwhelmed. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But how do we begin to play with that doorway, opening it a little bit, letting in a little bit more, closing it? Yeah,
you know, in your writing, you talk a great deal about mycelium.
Yeah.
You talk about, and you use that as not only, it's more than just a metaphor for you. I think that it actually is, there's a sensory or...
It's a lyrical ideogram. It's like the way, it's the thing that arrived to me that helped my brain work. I don't even mean that it's like a substance I took. I mean, like, it was a way of thinking. And I think we all have our cognitive companions that come and help us think. Yeah.
How did that come to you?
I think I loved mushrooms when I was little. I mean, I grew up in the Hudson Valley. And I was like down on the ground and like looking at things and like pulling up like roots and looking at little dangly mycelium. Not that I knew that what that was at that point. But for me, it was really this aha moment of realizing I was in college where I was fascinated with mycorrhizal networks and there wasn't that much information about them yet. And I had read Deleuze and Guattari and found it to be like really, really interesting and dry and like not rooted in ecology. And I was trying to find some way to think about rhizomes in a much more ecologically, scientifically interesting way and doing this research. And as that was happening, as my love of mycology and fungi was deepening into this mycorrhizal area of study, I got diagnosed finally. I'd been mysteriously ill for a really long time. With a connective tissue disease. And so it was this very kind of vertiginous, weird moment where I was like fascinated with the connective tissue of the soil and realizing that all of my health issues were connective tissue issues. So it was like a moment where I realized that this was like had been planted in my body genetically, like since birth. So yeah, I mean, and that's my interpretation, but it definitely felt like I had grown into my purpose. I had found the being that I was wedded to.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. I feel like, I'm trying to figure out how to ask this question or say this, but my experience with mushrooms, we were just touching on psychedelics, but the experiences that I've had with them has always felt like it was an actual intelligent being, or not even a being. It felt like a collection of beings.
Yeah.
And it was showing me things, and it was actually speaking to me almost in this hive mind thing. It was very, and it was mischievous, but also it contained multitudes, I guess.
Yeah. It feels very, like it feels chattering. It feels like it has a lot to say. And it's bumptious and kind of unruly, puckish. You know, I always think of the fermented gods, like very Dionysian. I've had that experience too, and I've done mushrooms. For me, the big experience, the big paradigm shift was about time. When I had psilocybin experience, I experienced time as flowing backwards. And as feeling my future flowing back into me and feeling moments begin to recursively spiral. It was a real, it troubled my idea of the arrow of time.
Yeah. Yeah. Seems like mushrooms, when they do that, it seems like it does disrupt not only your perception of time, but the way it flows.
Yeah.
And that seems like a common thing. And I think there's a lesson in that, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, quantum physics and, you know, Libet's delay, there's a lot of pretty mainstream science out there that says we don't really understand how time works. Is it this kind of a Minkowski like cube? Like, are we just like a snake that exists along our whole timeline and we're experiencing this one moment, but we really exist along our whole life? Yeah, I mean, there are lots of interesting questions about that, especially about readiness potential. Do you know about this? You know, they've done these studies, lipid studies are the most famous ones. I think those were in the 80s, where they would show that people would make decisions, but their bodies were registering them and preparing them before they cognitively made the decision. And also that you can shock someone and they'll be preparing for it in their body before they receive the shock without knowing that they're going to receive it. So all these strange temporal kind of glitches in scientific studies that trouble our ideas of free will, of causality. Yeah.
Do you think that when we're talking about, I think you said sense gating?
Yeah, sensory gating, yeah.
Sensory gating, yeah. That part of our sensory apparatus or our ability to anticipate things on that sort of that way you've described time itself, yeah. that like taking a psychedelic experience, which just feels like a door gets flung open, right? Yeah. That our kind of feeling this out right now.
Yeah, go for it.
That by doing that, by having that experience you described with time, that is a part of our, I'm going to use the word, say sensory apparatus, but our ability to anticipate something that's like pulling us towards it. We may not know what that thing is, but we know that we are about to do it, or it is about to be done to us.
Yeah. I mean, have you read anything by Eric Worgo?
I haven't.
Okay. Really, really fun. Or listen to his interview with Michael Garfield on Future Fossils, like whatever. He's an amazing like amateur. He's a hobbyist. He loves science. He loves quantum physics. He acknowledges that this is like not his area of expertise, and yet he still writes about it in a very interesting, compelling way. And he's interested in the fact that pretty much all cultures up until very recently believed in some form of precognition and precognitive dreams and prophecy. And that if we actually look at how dreams work, I mean, Freud, this is fascinating. Freud had to work really hard to disprove how many prophetic dreams he was having and his patients were having. And if you actually look at them on paper all together, you're like, whoa, that's a lot. Like, you have to really work hard at a certain point to say, what's going on here? And I think in our own lives, we can look back at our biographies and see that we've been kind of primed and made ready for certain events in ways that we couldn't know about as they were happening. But if we look backwards, we see that we were kind of the guardian angel of our own self. We were like positioning ourselves perfectly.
Yeah, I think a lot of us have had similar experiences that are like that. I wonder what that means on a collective level. You know, we're discussing climate and, you know, that it's like really loud now. It's just like everything's happening. And I feel like everything that's been happening for the past few years, at least, because I think we've been, you know, in our bones, we've known that this was going to happen.
Yeah.
And in a way, like my friend, we were talking about this. He describes like the sort of mass psychosis that we're experiencing seemingly. Is because of this deep denial of something that we've already been sensing, that the earth is changing, and it's we know the reasons.
Yeah.
And and it's affecting us on a behavioral level. Yeah. And we're seeing the results of that now, you know.
Well, and I think that the culture has been gaslighting the people who felt this on a very bodily, very real level, you know. One of my close family friends is a climate journalist, and for about 15 years, he's been talking about this. And he said to me, I remember like 5 years ago, he was like, the apocalypse is happening already. It just hasn't mm-hmm. drifted upwards. It's affecting all of the South. It's affecting the minorities. It's affecting the poorest populations, the third world countries. It just hasn't quite reached us yet. But it's not like going to happen. It has happened.
Right.
And I think this past year has really been that, you know, the wave has finally reached us. It's here. It was already happening, but now we're feeling the effects.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like all this... I think that's the thing. I don't know if it's not justice or retribution. I don't know what it is. It's none of those words, but it's that thing of, you know, there's no place to go in this. There's no way to escape it. There's always been, I think, within the way things have played out over hundreds of years through colonization and global capitalism and the hierarchies that are imposed because of that, and you could go through all of that, that to a certain degree, those of us in the global north, and particularly those that have benefited under sort of a patriarchal form, have been able to buffer themselves on some level from the impacts of that that hierarchy, you know, on people that have been kind of exploited under that, right? We can buffer ourselves from the effects of that, but this is one of those things where I don't see how, you know, it really is bubbling up to the top.
Yeah.
And affecting those that have.
Yeah. Something that's been talked about for a couple of years in chronic and terminal illness groups that I've participated in has been that, you know, more and more young people are very seriously ill. And I think that there has been an experience that, like, people who have disability and chronic illness have felt this beforehand. They've felt that precognitive pulse in their own bodies. And I do think that there are people who are kind of the canaries in the coal mine who feel these things beforehand. And I have noticed that there have been, I felt more seen ecologically and more believed about climate change when I was in groups of people who were the survivors of abuse and trauma and seriously ill. It was an interesting thing, phenomenon, that those were the people, they felt it in their bodies before other people did.
Yeah, I mean, has your, the condition that you have, has that allowed you to, do you feel like you yourself feel like a canary in the coal mine on a certain level? Like, that you're able to perceive and feel things or experience things in a way that others maybe can conveniently ignore. Do you feel that way about yourself, at least? And
I think whenever you have a non-normative physical experience, you can either frame it as being a symptom or as a superpower. And it really depends on how you want to narrativize it. I think that my body is extraordinarily sensitive to chemicals and to toxins and to foods and to stimuli, in a way that is often like very, very dramatic. So that can be scary and intense and could limit my life if I wanted it to, but it's also a way of thinking about my body as being kind of like an alarm signal. Like, yeah, like I'm like the fire alarm in the house where there's a gas leak and no one else has noticed it yet, but I'm going off. Which is, you know, it's interesting. Yeah. And the joke has always been, yeah, I sensed a gas leak in my house before we actually got it noticed and no one else sensed it. So I'm always sensitive to these small changes in chemicals and, pesticides and toxins. Yeah.
Well, I think that makes sense when talking about this, because like reading your essays, there's a very, I mean, it's like a palpable sensual thing that I feel when I read that, and you write that into whatever it is, and it's just, it's felt. And I think that's part of why that's how I became aware of you, is because of how I think you're becoming incredibly popular as far as people that really appreciate your writings or sharing them, which is well deserved. But it, yeah, it's like you've taken this thing, and I'm not here to do this thing where it's like you have a, you know, a disability or this issue, and you've like, you know, pulled yourself up by your bootstraps and made yourself this, you know, I'm not doing that. But I do think that through that way that you're living in your body, you've become attuned to something that most people are kind of numb to.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing that I've been thinking about is if you're so in your body, like, you know, extreme pain events, extreme, like I've had NDEs, like where I thought I was going to die and everyone else thought I was going to die. They bring you back into your body, actually, in such an exquisite, intense way. And you can think about that as being agonizing, but it also makes you available to extreme pleasure. And so what I want to make available to people is, yeah, to embody, to drop back into ourselves right now is to feel the pain, but it is also to feel the pleasure that we have been denying ourselves for so long. They both exist simultaneously. We have to be able to hold them both.